Am I on the screen for this?
1935, am I on the Lions screen? Win the NFL championship. The Detroit Tigers take the World Series. The Red Wings bring home Lord Stanley's Cup. Joe Louis begins his rise to world domination. This transforms the Motor City into Detroit, City of Champions.
There you go. There's the crack of the bat.
Crack and of the bat. I love the sound, man.
And running Detroit City of Champions, the podcast. Accompanying the books written by
Charles Avison.
I'm Jamie Flanagan, and we are jumping into these books, telling the stories of the Lions, the Tigers, the Red Wings, and now deep, seven chapters deep.
We're deep. We're
into the Joe Louis story.
44 episodes into the whole show.
Yeah.
It's our episode 44, yeah, man. Yeah, yeah. For one season.
Excited about that.
For
and
one
I think
season.
We've been through about 44 bottles of whiskey.
Yeah,
too.
We're on our, yeah,
40, as well.
Yeah, we'd run Very Old Barton tonight. Learning some new stuff every day.
So, yeah, just enjoy. But again, I just want to thank everybody. Take a second before we get going on the story. Thank everybody who's tuned in. And is following along with the story. If you just found it fresh this time, make sure you stop right now and do this. Just take a couple of seconds and go to wherever you collect your podcasts and listen to podcasts and then subscribe, like, follow, or collect, or whatever it is you
share
do.
Share it. Yes.
Put
a
comment. And then make a comment.
Yeah.
And then
like it, especially likes if it's on YouTube. Hit like right now. Do us a huge favor right now.
Yeah. That's massive. So, and leave a comment. We love getting the comments. And so if you're joining us while we do it live, you can comment, and we pull those comments into the conversation. And
one of these days, we'll have like a whole like live stream where we're talking to people like right through the thing. That'd be cool.
That's the hope. So, but thank you for joining us for Detroit City of Champions, the trilogy of books. There's a screenplay. We're going to get into the screenplay
today
a little bit.
Today,
you said you teased me a little bit before, and you said because you want to introduce one of these segments about Joe Louis in a special way, and so we're going to get to that. And and so thanks for joining us. Like, subscribe, and thank you for being here. And Charles. Where are we at with Joe? Because this is episode 44, seven chapters into Joe's story.
So we've covered the sort of the where Joe Louis came from. He came from Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of they call it the Great Migration North, where it was all the northern cities were just massive opportunities, and so there was a huge migration of descendants of former slaves and this and that. I mean, it was a huge migration north. There was a ton of opportunity. And so, Detroit was one of the hot, it's said that when you got off the train in Detroit, they would literally grab you off the train and send you right to a factory to work.
Wow, I mean, there were that many jobs.
There were so many jobs that were...
Sounded scary there for a second.
No, there
was... It probably was a little scary for some people.
Well, I'm sure, yeah, but they were probably nice to know that there was a job.
Oh, you're taking me to a job. That's better.
So, I mean, the jobs were just in abundance, and then, of course, the Great Depression hit, and then those jobs disappeared, and then and so now everybody's just eking out a survival. And we talked about Joe, the life in Detroit, how Joe went from living in this world where it was this rural, quiet life in Alabama, and then all of a sudden now he's in this crazy hustle bustle city of Detroit. It's like a complete world shift.
My mom had a similar experience. She was born in 32. And just had dinner with her today. She's 90 in January.
Well, nice.
She's crazy. So we're hanging out having dinner. But she's born at 32. It must have been like 40, 42, somewhere in there. My grandfather, her dad, was a coal miner in Pennsylvania. And around 40, 42, they moved here to Detroit. So my grandmother, my grandfather, on my mom's side, both straight off the boat from Poland, no English whatsoever.
Really?
Still no English, and their daughter's 8 years old. And so they got here, and my mom remembers her dad came like a month before to set up house and get things going. And her mom came, and she remembers carrying a phonograph. She had a portable phonograph, and coming into the train station that's being rebuilt.
Michigan Central,
really
nice.
Coming, pulling into, and then she had to get the taxi and get the directions because my grandmother didn't speak English, and so my mom at 8 or 9 or whatever it was had to facilitate this whole thing and get them from. the train station to Hamtramck. So, but yeah, so she tells me that scene all the time, and I love it. And so when
she
went straight
to Hamtramck too, the Polish.
Oh yeah, that's like, where else are they going?
Yeah, it's not even, it's not just a stereotype.
Yeah,
that's literally.
They went straight to
Hamtramck.
Sure. That's exactly where they had to go.
But as soon as she got to Hamtramck, there's Polish speakers in abundance. Probably all this little Poland.
Oh, it is. Yeah. So, but yeah, when you tell this story, when she tells that story, and I am, you tell the story about Joe getting off the train. And his family moving here at that time. I totally envision that.
Yeah, that whole scenario. Yeah, absolutely. You know? Exactly. Yeah. It's a totally different world.
So he's living in this world.
Plus the excitement of it. Yeah. It's got to be exciting at the same time, too.
Yeah, okay.
To come off of it, you know, you're just like, okay, now here we are. You know, the streets are laid with gold. And it's like, oh, hold on a second. It's not exactly that, but it's a new world. It's a totally new world.
So, and then the bottom falls out for the depression for Joe.
Yeah, it falls out. The bottom falls out. Now it's just a struggle for survival, and there's just, you know, there's, you know, Joe, he wasn't good at school. They try to get him in a trade school. You know, he was okay at, you know, doing some woodwork and stuff like this. But he ended up like doing various jobs, like, you know, like one of the things that he gives credit for, like the way that his body developed is like his muscular physique was carrying blocks of ice.
Oh, wow.
And that's a story I can identify with because I live in Detroit and I live in a building that's like at least 100 years old.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And so there's actually I think I showed it to you like one of the permanent fixtures in my unit in this old unit that I live in. Is this cabinet that on the inside, right now it's just, for me, it's just a little small, it's a storage cabinet.
Sure, sure.
But if you look on the outside of the cabinet, you know, out in the hallway, there's like a window that opens up from the outside, and you put the ice blocks in through the window, and then it drops right into like where that fridge would be.
Wow.
So back in the day, it was a fridge, and they would drop the ice blocks in, and then there would be a pipe that radiates the cool air through your fridge.
Wow.
And so that's what I mean. So like, I just think it's super cool, you know, like I can actually see how they would have done it, which, you know, somebody just delivering ice, they didn't just like come in your place and drop it off. They would just lift up that door and drop the ice block in. You know, and you'd have like a subscription where, you know, you can get ice 3 times a week or five times a week or something like this. So anyway, so that was, you know, so Joe was just eking out a living, trying to scrape up, you know, here, you know, money wherever they could. And all the money went back to the family. And then his mom would, they would take the money from all the kids and from their husband and this. And then, you know, they would divvy it out to wherever it needed to go. And so Joe was incredible. You know, his mother, Lily, was a, you know, God-fearing woman, you know, raised them in this, you know, fundamental Christian belief.
Right.
And so Joe was, you know, it was a very strong family structure that they had. And Joe was, you know, as we're going to see throughout his entire, you know, emerging career, Joe was just absolutely die-hard loyal to his family. His money... I mean, Joe started to get into some luxury items a little bit, bulk of his money was going home to his mom, and his mom was still divvying it up. And he really got into boxing because he had a talent for it. He loved it. He loved the road work. He loved to be part of the group, you know, like when they're, you know, training for boxing and that. And he saw a potential way, even as an amateur, he could earn, like, you know, vouchers at different merchandise, you know, different stores. Just for boxing
Wow.
And so he got into it for that, and then
his mom
some of the money that his mom divvied up. She thought for some reason that Joe had some musical aptitude, and she started pinching off some of the money that, you know, it's kind of an interesting thing that as tough as times were, that the money that was coming in, and she divvied it up to the different directions that she thought was important for the family, and a portion of that she was putting into Joe taking violin lessons, which is, you know, I mean, it shows that they're not just putting it all into food and this and that. She was, you know, she's trying to help Joe find where he fits in.
One of 16?
Eight kids of hers. And I think it was, eight of hers. And then they joined with Pat Brooks, who had eight of his own. Eight or nine of their.
Yeah.
I got it written down. Joe's the eighth of nine. So I think it was nine of each. So 18, I think, total. Yeah, but there were various ages. By the time Joe was 17, 18 years old, half of them have moved out at least.
Yeah, but
and
still.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a huge family. It's a totally different, you know, experience. But it's just interesting that she would say, but she's so, you know, trying to, she's so, you know, interested in all of her kids that the eighth of nine children, she's trying to find where he fits in. She thinks he's got some musical aptitude. sends him out to violin lessons, and he's taking the money instead, of course, and famously putting him into boxing lessons.
Right,
you know,
and he made it. He got into the Golden Gloves, and then we went Chicago. Last week we were talking all about 1934.
How he's just a rising star.
Right.
You know, I mean, at least in his, you know, in their little world, like, because his first fight was like $59, and his second fight was like $62 that he made.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's one of the, that we'll show that graphic maybe at the end.
Right.
Because every fight that he has is getting more and more money.
Right.
And so, you know, especially the cool thing is to see where he started to where he's going to finish,
mm-hmm.
how much money he makes along the way, and, you know, which is just insane amounts of money for this humble guy, this guy from, mm-hmm. you know, who's originally his prospects for doing anything, from an exterior perspective, you know, he's got no chance. He's coming out of Black Bottom Detroit, eighth of nine kids. You know, he's not good in school, adequate at construction. And so that's what I mean. Like, he does find this thing that he likes and he pursues it. And he, you know, it's just the perfect combination of, like, he was the perfect person. He got, like, as far as, like, the opera, you know, he was absolutely at the right place in the right time. Everything came together for this man.
Right.
Everything really came together for him. And that's what we're kind of showing is he made it through the amateur ranks. He finds somebody that, you know, John Roxborough, who's going to actually put money into him to help, you know, so he doesn't have to work so much and he can mm-hmm. focus more on the training. And then, you know, he wins the amateur, he wins the Gold Gloves. And then John Roxborough, they declare they want to go pro. So they find his business partner who's also interested in sponsoring him. And then they find Jack Blackburn, the trainer,
right.
who's like the most perfect, like, Jack Blackburn, we spent a lot of time talking about him.
Yeah,
he was
you're
like
great.
The most prototypical, like, Mickey from Rocky, like the most perfect, you know, trainer for Joe. He was the complete opposite. But the two of them, you know, like, we talked about how they called each other Chappie as a sign of endearment.
Yeah.
And so now we're going to be talking about 1935. And we left off last episode talking about how Joe, as a sort of out of nowhere Christmas surprise, was found out that he was in the top 10 of Ring Magazine.
Wow.
So this is a whole different world. And they'd try to reach out to the Madison Square Gardens to try to get a fight there because that's where the real big money was.
Sure.
And they were denied. He was like, you know, the guy Jimmy Johnson, as we're going to meet here during this show, Jimmy Johnson refused him. He said there's no money in color, in his words, colored fighters.
Right,
there's no money in it. Nobody wants to see a colored fighter anymore.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and so Joe, they were denied from doing anything big in Madison Square Garden. And so today we're going to be talking about, you know, the beginning of 1935 and the true beginning of the rise of Joe Louis. We make a bold claim from the beginning of this show. I make a bold claim, and the goal is to prove it, that this was the greatest individual season in the history of American sport. And as we've said a couple times in the last couple episodes, we're starting with a handicap because, spoiler alert, Joe Louis does not win the heavyweight championship in 1935. Yet, despite that, he's starting with a handicap of saying, despite the fact that he did not win the championship in his respective sport, it was still the greatest individual season in the history of American sport. And if we're able to prove this to be true, if we're able to make a good enough case that this is true, what that does is elevate the City of Champions story to a level that cannot be matched. Because what it does is if you have the greatest season, it's my claim that this is the greatest season in the history of American sport. 1930, the season which stretches from 1935 to 1936, especially the seven-month span in which all three teams, Tigers, Lions, Red Wings, win their first championships in the same season, that this stretch of time was the greatest overall season by any city in the history of American sport. That's my overall claim, right? But if we can prove successfully, or at least make a good enough claim that, you know, to leave very few doubts, that the greatest individual season came as part of the greatest overall season,
right?
Then it extends the case to say that no city will ever match it, because in order to do so, you would have to have an individual season that eclipses Joe Louis, never be done.
And that was Jesse chimed in, and Jesse said,
"My boy Jesse, how you doing, Jesse?
Could a man like Joe Louis work up the ranks in boxing society today? Is boxing too saturated with politics for something like this to happen today?"
Yeah, I mean, well, here's the thing is that the thing about boxing is that people love knockouts. there's a truism that go that's
Tyson was
through.
So bloody popular.
There you go. If you know how to knock people out on a regular basis and leave them hung over the ropes like sacks of wheat, like Joe Louis did.
If you know
how to just eviscerate people on a daily basis, then you got a good chance of breaking through the barriers of the bureaucratic world. That's not to say it's a guarantee, but especially we're going to dive into today the situation of boxing in 1935 to show that boxing was actually in desperate need of a star. Boxing was really in trouble at this point in its history. There was no real true superstar, and so there was a vacuum for somebody like Joe Louis to step in, and that's what I mean when he was the perfect person at the right time. Really everything I look at Joe Louis as a sort of a child of destiny almost, where it was like, not that it was easy for him, but he was the perfect person for this moment in time, for this sport, for right. this era.
So to answer Jesse's question, it's lightning striking twice. It's possible, but not likely.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, yeah, but I'm just saying, if you're talking about nobody like Joe Louis will ever come along, the thing that transcends all sports, and this is it's a whole other project with the baseball analytics thing. Baseball's struggling. I think I'm at the right time to introduce something new for baseball because, it's kind of like anything. If you got the thunder, if you got the real thunder, if you got the shockwave, if you got Thor's hammer, if you got the trident that freaking gets electric, the fish listen to. You see what I'm saying? Have the sonic boom, okay? Then there's a way to break through the bureaucracy. Because as we're going to see today, what happens is that the bureaucracy that stands in front of you gets removed because there's a single core component that dominates all freaking bureaucracy, and it breaks through all different freaking of all barriers, and that is the power to make money.
Right.
Okay, the power to make money and draw interest and put butts in the seats for an entertainment. That's what breaks through all bureaucracy.
Right.
And if the bureaucracy doesn't get out of that way, then it gets crushed and swept aside,
right,
and a new bureaucracy emerges.
So
where we're starting off today is January 4th, 1935, the very beginning of the year.
Yeah, all right.
We don't waste any time as far as when the year begins, okay? And so I did want to do something special today for the show, a little bit different. And so I was thinking about it. I'm like, okay, I just kind of wrote the notes, and I'm like, okay, Joe Louis fights Patsy Perrone, Max Baer. It was in Olympia Stadium.
Yeah,
in Detroit.
Yeah.
Joe's back in Detroit from Chicago.
Right.
He's Max Baer is the heavyweight champion, and Max Baer is the overcard, okay? He's like the main draw of the fight at Olympia Stadium, and Joe is an undercard. Joe is a heavyweight, but he's fighting in the shadow of Max Baer. Very few people know who Joe Louis was. Right, like we said before, he might have been ranked number 10 in Ring Magazine, but as far as the name Joe Louis is a household name, was non-existent.
Sure.
And so, I was looking at it, I'm just going, hold on a second. I did for the first step for episode 2 of my screenplay.
I already wrote this.
Yeah, and again, everything I did for the screenplay was historical fact. I did not exaggerate. Mm-hmm. I did not put I added conversation in where there was none, but I didn't make up things that didn't happen, and I didn't demonize good people, at least good people the way I saw it, and I didn't change facts in order to morph it to make it fit in the story. I didn't need to.
Sure.
Okay. So I thought, that being the case, I might as well read off the intro couple of pages of my screenplay, because that's where this story begins in the screenplay, as well as our narrative today.
Sock it to me, man.
So I think there's a little more color in the screenplay than.
So
there
we got
is.
We got a picture of what Olympia Stadium looked like.
Yeah,
so in December of 34 here. So is the month
so
before
just a
these
couple,
fights
it's really,
took place.
It's actually those are written straight out of the book.
Yeah.
And those photos, I actually the caption of my book is 2 weeks before this fight.
Okay.
So this is as contemporary as you're going to get. I mean, this is right at that time. This is what Olympia Stadium looked like, with the boxing ring, of course, instead of the ice arena. So anyway, so this is episode. What I'm going to read you is the first really couple pages. I practiced it today. It only took me about 3 or 4 minutes to read. And so it's also putting me on the spot a little bit, okay? Because, you know, we're talking about doing a movie, right? This is nobody's read the screenplay yet. It really has not been out there. And so, for the listener, the watcher, the people who are listening to this right now, this is where, like, from what I've understand about screenplays, most of the time the producers and them read the first like five pages.
Yeah.
Okay. And if it hasn't captured their interest and ready to, like, you know, to listen to more of it, then it's pretty much a dud. Okay. That's where they leave off, and it's pretty much a dud. And so. And so I'm putting myself kind of on the spot because if it's not good, you our faithful listeners and watchers, will be bored. You will turn us out.
Clicking away.
You'll be clicking off of us, and you'll say, Charles' screenplay isn't going to sell anybody because it didn't even hold my interest. Okay, and one of their fans. We'll leave it to you to decide how we start this out, right? I got confidence. I got faith that, because I wouldn't put something out there that's trash. So, So I don't know, Jamie. You got faith? Are you?
I got faith. I got faith in you. I've read it.
My man.
All right. I'm in.
So this is page one of the screenplay. And there's a little bit of, I'm going to have to read it.
Here buying the drinks, damn it.
Yeah, you got it, man. So anyway, there's a couple little like screenplay, like, you know, things like the beginning, fade in, just like in a movie, the fade in is when the screen opens. So those are all written into the screenplay. This particular one is 83.
Curtain up,
this
fade
this
in.
Is so this comes from episode 2. This is a 9-part miniseries. And so this is from episode 2. This is the very first page. So imagine you're watching this on Netflix right now.
When we last left our hero.
Yeah, so we last left it with Joe Lewis, and we talked about it at the end of last episode where Joe had found out that he was ranked in the top 10.
I just do a narrator voice. Pay no attention to me.
So anyways, so that's where the episode one left off with Joe finding out that he was ranked in the top 10. It was a Christmas party with Jack Blackburn came over. Talking about it.
That magazine, that's wonderful.
Exactly. So this is where episode two starts off. Imagine, like you say, you're watching on Netflix, and then I'm going to read it right off for you to hear. All right, so the fade in. So the interior, Detroit, Olympia Stadium, evening. A huge, raucous crowd of 16,000 people is booing and cheering for a boxing match taking place in the center of a large enclosed arena. Super. Super means that, like, the text on the screen says where you're at. So super, Olympia Stadium, Detroit, January 4th, 1935. The arena is obviously used for hockey, as indicated by the white, curved wooden boards which divide the crowd into bleachers and ringside seats. Two white boxers are the focal point of the room. All eyes, jeers, and cheers are focused on one of them in particular. Super, Max Baer versus Babe Hunt. Voices in the crowd. Come on, Max, we paid to see a fight. Get in there and fight, you bum. Boo! Max Baer is built like an Adonis. He is 6'2", 210 pounds of muscle with broad shoulders, dark black hair, good looks, and a white Star of David on his blue shorts. He toys with his opponent, Babe Hunt. One moment delivering a series of blows, the next a comedy routine that only he finds funny. A huge smile is now stretched across his face as he points to a pretty girl in the crowd and flexes his bicep for her. Voices in the crowd. You're a bum, Max. Clown and fool. Glad you're having fun, because this is a joke. You're a joke, Max. Heavyweight champ my ass. Max senses his opponent behind him, and he turns to meet him. Crack, crack. Max socks Babe Hunt, staggering him and forcing him to retreat. It buys Max time to turn towards the crowd and blow kisses. Max Baer, love me, love me. Pointing at someone random in the crowd. You don't love me? Well, I love you. Babe Hunt once again tries to take advantage of the situation, but as he moves in, Max suddenly spins around and cold cocks him with a backhand punch. The brutal gloved slap in the face once again stuns Hunt. The referee is furious. Referee, damn it, Max, I told you, you can't do that. Max Baer, sarcastically waving to the referee to leave him alone. Get out of here, it ain't in the rule book. Max now turns his attention to a man holding a huge camera with a flash bulb. He leans against the turnbuckle, crosses his arms, and flash, the camera bulb pops. Max appears to be speaking with the newspaper man as ding, ding, the bell rings, the bell sounds, and the fight is over. Max is still leaning against the turnbuckle, talking as the crowd unleashes a full-throated cascade of boos, which he seems to enjoy as much as if they were cheering him. The referee must nearly drag him from his conversation in order to raise his arm in victory. The ring announcer climbs to the ring with a microphone. Ring announcer, the winner and still heavyweight champion of the world, the Livermore LaRupper, Max Baer. Another torrent of boos as Max makes his exit from the ring. His handlers try to clear a path for him, but the crowd is so angry that he must push his way through to the locker rooms. At the same moment that Max is exiting the ring, Joe and Jack Blackburn are making their way to it from a completely different direction. The focus of the crowd, however, is so much on Max that Lewis's entrance is barely noticed. Joe Lewis enters the ring and removes his tan robe with Detroit gold gloves stitched on the back. Moments later, his opponent, Patsy Peroni, enters the ring and removes his robe as well. Super. Joe Lewis versus Patsy Peroni. Ring announcer. Olympia Stadium is proud to bring you our final fight of the evening. A heavyweight battle between the man to my right in the maroon trunks out of Cleveland, Ohio, and ranked number 7 in the world, Patsy Peroni. Brief hand clapping and applause. Ring announcer. And the man to my left in the black trunks and out of your Detroit, Michigan, and ranked number 9 in the world, Joe Lewis. Slightly longer and more sustained applause, but nothing compared to the noise surrounding Bear. Joe returns to his corner. Blackburn gives him a final few words of strategy. Jack Blackburn. Remember, Chappie, he's got a great left hook, but he's got to get set to use it. Don't let him get set. Use your jab to stop it. Joe Lewis, what happens if he hits me with the hook? Jack Blackburn, use your jab and you won't get hit. Joe Lewis, I guess I'll jab then. The referee motions for both fighters to come to the center of the ring. Referee, okay, boys, the last fight was a joke. Give this crowd something to cheer for. Nothing below the belt, tap gloves, and come out fighting. Joe and Patsy tap gloves and momentarily return to their corners. Ding, ding, the fight is on. Round one, both boxers emerge from their corners and their strategies are immediately obvious. Joe with his constant jab, while Patsy tries various combinations in an attempt to unleash his left hook. Each time Patsy attempts to throw his left hook, he gets stung in mid-swing by Joe's jab. Both fighters are merely feeling each other out, though Joe gets the best of the exchanges and wins the round. Ding, ding, round one ends. Jack Blackburn, giving Joe a drink of water and drying the sweat off his forehead with a towel. Yeah, he's definitely looking to land that hook. Blackburn looks around at the crowd who are asleep compared to the frenzy they were in with Bear. Time to introduce yourself, Chappie. Keep feeding him that jab, but give him the opening he's looking for and cross your right hook over his left. Let's wake this crowd up. Joe Lewis, okay, chap. Round two, ding, ding. The two fighters emerge much the same way they did the first round. Joe's jab stunning Patsy every time he tries to set himself to throw his left hook. Then exactly as Blackburn told him, Joe drops his guard. Patsy sees his opening and quickly cocks his left, but Joe is too quick. He whistles a right hook to Patsy's jaw, flooring him immediately. The crowd cheers wildly as the referee counts. Joe stands quietly and expressionless in his corner. Peroni slowly stands and is fully up at the count of 9. Several seconds later, ding, ding, round two is over. The vocal frustrations vented at the clowning Max Bear have now morphed into cheers. Flash go the cameras at the local boy who sits quietly in his corner listening to his trainer. A young white newspaper reporter, Bob Murphy, indicated by the Detroit Times press pin on his jacket, sits next to the cameraman and scribbles furiously into a notebook. His voice as he writes his article will trumpet over the excited background sounds of the fight and serve as the narration and description of it. Montage. So keep in mind, he's writing, his voice in his head is going to serve as the narration as the fight continues in a montage where it's like a sort of time moving forward. Montage, Joe Lewis versus Patsy Peroni. So this is Bob Murphy voiceover. So this is Bob Murphy's voice you hear. You hear them talk about, so as you hear this, imagine you're seeing Joe Lewis and fighting in the background and sure. Fighting Patsy Peroni at the same time. So Bob Murphy voiceover. You hear them talk about certain football players who have ice water in their veins. Let them talk. But you will probably never find a more nonchalant, cold-blooded individual than this Joe Lewis. He apparently never changes his expression. You do not see pain or surprise registered when his opponent catches him on the nose or chin. Neither does he change that facial expression when he has his foe nailed. 3 times last night, Joe Lewis, the dusky dynamited, had Peroni down for the count of 9. He was not one whit excited. His expression remained the same, cold and heartless. The professor could borrow Joe Lewis's face and make $1 million at poker. Perhaps it was in contrast of Bear's clowning, but I am of the conviction that I have just seen the best heavyweight prospect in many years. He is quick and well-coordinated, can hit from any angle. He boxes beautifully and hits with deadly force. He didn't knock out Peroni. The Ohio heavyweight was too game, rugged, durable, but that was after being knocked down in the second round. Peroni was in there only to stay the distance, and he had to labor prodigiously to accomplish even that. When decision was announced in favor of Lewis, Patsy's face and body was gruesomely scarred with a welter of bruises from the terrific punishment he had suffered. End of montage. The referee raises the hand of Joe Lewis as a sign of victory as the stoic-faced boxer watches the bloody, swollen-faced Peroni being helped out of the ring by his trainers.
Wow.
Super. Joe Louis versus Patsy Peroni, 10th round decision. Purse, $4,227. Super. Joe Louis record, 13-0, 10 KOs. Super. Career purse total, $9,121. So, yeah, this is – so, anyways, that's my intro of the story.
I like it.
So it's a contrast between Max Bear's clowning and Joe coming out there, deadly serious business, seeing Joe, seeing the evolution. Because now the previous episodes we've seen, it was sort of ragtag fights. Mm-hmm. It was sort of, you know, Joe's an amateur. He's coming up. Now he's got a real crowd behind him. Now he's fighting in the same arena as the heavyweight champion. And now he's showing up. The heavyweight champion by this in this, and by the way, that quote I read to you, I could show you right this. That quote is literally from the day after.
Yeah,
that is the literal quote. That's Bob Murphy, literal quote from the day after that fight. That's what I'm talking about when I say historically accurate. Everything for the entire screenplay was using anywhere that I could use exact phrases, exact quotes. Every single moment is true. That's what I want to give the movie soul and substance is literally bringing back the voices and scenes from the past. You see,
yeah,
and you know that was. I mean, it's right out of the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it's right out of the book from the day after that fight. He was watching the fight. That's what he sees, and on the movie screen for that Netflix thing, that's what the viewers are going to hear.
Mm-hmm.
The voice, like I say, one of the things I've said since the very beginning of this is. This story was passed to me by a whisper, and I'm gonna bring it back with a shout.
There you go. And so this was January 4th, and we're four days
into 1935. With
and,
Joe.
And this person is already seeing Joe as this.
You can already see it. I mean, I just watched this guy just.
He's got a flurry of fights within the first 3 months of this year.
Yeah, we're not going to. Yeah, like I say, the fights are going to really form the framework of the story. I think where it's appropriate. We're not going to go through every fight like this. We're not going to dive into it. But it's just really cool that the Olympia. This first fight of 1935, which is going to be this incredible year, is at Olympia Stadium.
Right.
And that these people could actually see it. They're like, we're about to see something special here. I mean, this guy, he just tore him up. So,
but if people don't have the book, if they're just listening to the audio, it might be worth a jump over to Facebook or YouTube to see the video because we got the images up. What can you tell me about these three images? Are these all from the book?
All these photos are all basically. It's all I do is go through my books and do
these are from the fight.
Yeah,
these are from the fight you were talking about.
Yeah, high resolution fights and high resolution photos right out of the book. I just crop them and put them on the slide.
Okay.
So yeah, but those photos there, all these photos we're gonna be showing. Every photo I show, these are incredibly rare.
This Patsy, because they talk about how he's tattered and torn at the end of it.
Yeah,
and you can see really that top photo.
Folded up, man. Broke his back.
Yeah.
Look at the first picture. He's taking a solid right from Jory to the face.
Right,
right.
Joe always, I mean, for being a heavyweight, at this point, he's boxing heavyweight, right?
Oh, absolutely. But just barely.
He doesn't look, he looks wiry here. Mm-hmm. He looks wiry. And my image
he's
is
young
Joe.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is a little older Joe.
The little older
little
Joe,
beefier
yeah.
Joe.
That's a lot of the image, yeah. But in 35, he's still, I forgot how, I'm so bad with the specific details.
This is,
I think
he's
like
22
or something like that.
Yeah.
This
is great.
He's super young. That's what I mean. And then so and that's what I mean. Like, that's one of the things I want to try to bring back here is this, there's this special era of 35 where all these guys are young. Like Hank Greenberg.
Yeah.
Everybody looks at Hank Greenberg and he's like, same kind of thing. Like every time you see a picture of Hank Greenberg, he's like well filled out. He's got a big chest. He's 6'4" or something. He's a big, big guy. But in 35, he was skinny. He was a 19-year-old, 20-year-old kid. They're all young.
Yeah, yeah.
It was this very special era where they're all, I forgot how old he is. He's like 21, okay. I think. Yeah. But I mean, he's young. They're all young at this point, And so that's what I mean. In this era, he's skinny. He's young. I mean, he's an elite athlete, of course. But Yeah, he looks different than a lot of the bulk of photos you see with Joe Louis are all from, right, you know, when he's, you know, in sort of mid career or sure, later. And, yeah. But the 35 is like this.
I love this
era.
Picture. I love that top picture. It's just his reach.
Yeah, he's catching
his determination.
The button. Yeah.
and the pain. It just that.
Yeah, that guy's taking a shot. Then you have other photos. You see what happens after.
Yeah, he's folded like a paper doll. Yeah.
So, you catch a shot from Joe and see how you stand. You know, the guy's going down.
All right.
But that's what he said. He goes, the guy was so, you know, that he goes, yeah, the guy made it through the 10th round decision, but he was lucky to even get to that. Like, yeah, that's what he's saying. Like, the entire rest of the fight, this guy knew he was done.
Yeah.
And so he's like, I just got to try to survive. He's like, he's too game to get knocked out. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, he was lucky to even get to the end, you know? So. So this is the first fight of the year. So then the second fight we're gonna is just a week later on January 11th.
A week later. Don't fighters take more time to train in between fights?
I think Tyson had in his first couple of years, he had quite a few fights too, especially when you're just plowing through people.
Yeah,
you know, and you're earning check after check after check, because like in the first fight with against Peroni, you got $4,200. That was the stat total. That from that one fight was the same total as he had made for the entire 1934.
Man,
I mean, that one fight was the combined, like 1930s. All of his money in 1934 was the same as this one fight. So like, yeah, he's making money. He's getting bigger and bigger checks. Absolutely, he's gonna be fighting because he's trying to build his record, and the hype is there. You know, people, he's starting to become in demand. So his next fight a week later, again, is a guy named Hans Berkey.
Hans.
Yeah, so he KOs in the 10th round in Pittsburgh, in Duquesne Gardens, Pittsburgh, and he earns himself a $1,900 check, which is a little, you know, obviously less than the previous, but still ain't bad, especially where he came from the previous year. And so his fight after that, his next fight is on, his third fight of 1935 is on February 21st, 1935, and he fights against Lee Ramage, who is that name for those listeners who are following along very closely, was in 19. This is his rematch against Lee Ramage, who he'd fought in the previous year. And so
doesn't look like Lee's faring as well this time around.
He's not. But here's the thing: is that Lee Ramage was a great boxer. Yeah. He was ranked in the top 9 or 10 boxers. He actually traded places with Joe after Joe beat him in the previous fight, because Joe was number 10. And then Lee Ramage was number 9. And so after he beat him, then Joe moves up to number 9, and Ramage drops down to 10. So he's a great fighter. Lee
it Ramage looks like one of these shots, it looks like he's literally knocked him off his feet. It looks like he's like in the air. That fourth one across the top there.
Yeah, well, the cool thing about the photo, anybody that can see the photos, the top photo is like, they call it a magic eye. Okay, where there's the four photos that are like, it's almost like a high speed camera where they take four shots like in rapid speed.
But these were just like four different photographers shooting.
No, I think they had a camera. It was called a Magic Eye camera. Oh, and it would take the four shots back to back to back to back.
Oh, okay.
And so you would,
that
so
was quite the innovation for 1935.
Absolutely, yeah. I actually have a photo in my book of the Magic Eye camera.
Oh, right on. Okay.
And so that's what they love to do it in the newspapers. Sure. They would put. I've got, and so because
that was very unique.
Because Magic Eyes were so popular then, they just littered the newspapers. Papers with all these different stuff. And so one of my objectives was to collect. I'm the biggest Magic Eye photo collector you've ever met. Have you ever met a Magic Eye photo collector? Mm-mm. Well, I'm definitely the biggest.
Probably the biggest. They turn that into a coffee table.
I
want to
see. So yeah. Oh, that's what I mean. Like, so I was collecting. Anytime I saw any Magic Eye,
okay,
I spared absolutely no expense and I spared no time in acquiring that image and restoring. Even if it took me a week to restore an image, I have one that's Alvin Crowder, General Crowder from the Tigers.
Wow.
And I found this. I mean, I've got a Magic Eye for every Tiger.
Oh, cool.
I think I've got one for every Tiger.
Okay.
And I've got one for virtually every player. And I mean, like, and not for the Lions, of course, but because there wasn't a very great Magic Eye camera style for them. But I've got them. I've got so many Magic Eye photos, you wouldn't even believe it. But the Alvin Crowder, I just remember because it took me like a week to restore that image because it was so messed up.
Oh, wow.
But I was able to, you know, make a usable picture of it. But so anyways, this was called a Magic Eye of Joe Louis, and there's going to be others. I've got a bunch of Magic Eye photos of Joe Louis. So, but it was at the time. It's a cool thing, and I think that newspapers and things of today could benefit from some cool stuff like that,
showing
that, you know, the Magic Eye of a moment, because it looks like a miniature movie reel inside of a newspaper.
Right.
So anyways, that's a magic guy, yeah, of Joe knocking out, what is that one, Hans Berkey?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Hans. Yeah. So anyway, so that's the second fight of the year.
No.
Lee Ramage. Okay. So this fight, you know, this fight, and this information comes out of the Richard Back book, who's been, incredible book. If anybody hasn't read it, you know, wants more information, especially in the early life of Joe Louis, Richard Back. The book's called The Great Black Hope, Joe Louis. But this information comes from his book, where he talks about a guy named Scotty Monteith, who was a huge boxing, you know, huge in the world of boxing at the time, and he was the one that he came up with the idea of the Brown Bomber nickname.
Okay,
like there's other credit to a guy for the Free Press that potentially came up with it too, but really it's at this point that the name Scotty Monteith is like. He was like calling up Joe's manager, like, you guys need to bill this guy as, you know, the Bomber, you know, the Brown Bomber. It's just such a great name, you know. And so that's what name really, from this point on, Joe is going to be the Brown Bomber. It's going to be in the newspapers. It's going to be on his jersey. It's on his robe. It's going to be on everything. And so so that was one of the big things that came out of this fight at this moment. And then the other big thing was that a guy who was going to have one of the biggest influences on Joe Louis' entire career, and is going to be responsible for Joe for the big opportunities that Joe's going to have coming up, and a central figure for the rest of the story we're going to tell today, Mike Jacobs, was in attendance at this fight. And so Joe earns a check for his payout, $4,354. He's in Los Angeles for this fight. He went all the way out to Los Angeles for this rematch against Lee Ramage, and picked up $4,354, a huge amount of money, of course.
All right.
And so anyway, so after this Lee Ramage fight, so Mike Jacobs is in attendance at this fight. And so now is where we got to talk about a little about Mike Jacobs and who this guy was. Okay. Yeah. So Mike Jacobs is like the classic, just prototypical, like, self-made man. Okay, this is a guy who started out, his family of Jewish immigrants coming over. Passed through Ireland to get through to America in 1880. He's born in 1880, so he's 55 years old in 1935. This guy grew up in Hell's Kitchen, New York.
Okay,
you hear of Hell's Kitchen?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay? Like, there's a certain panache that comes out of, like, yeah, you know, like, where are you from? I'm in New York City. Like, oh yeah, where are you from? Like, Hell's Kitchen. You're like,
okay.
Good Lord.
All right.
Yeah, you know, born and raised, there Hell's Kitchen. Yeah, you know, yeah. I think that's where they made Gangs in New York. Yeah, you know, like, the Hell's Kitchen was the store, was the setting for Gangs in New York. You're like, hey, you know, Hell's Kitchen, you know, oh yeah, when? Oh, you know, grew up, you know, early turn of the century.
You mean
the time with Bill the Butcher and, like, you know, where the Dead Rabbit Society. He's like, oh yeah, my buddy was in the Dead Rabbit Society. The era that this guy grew up in, the Hell's Kitchen. Okay, so that's, like, this guy is from, like, I mean, as far as, you know, your brutal sort of background, like, this is a guy that came from the, you know, literal tough part of New York City. And so as people that are, I'm assuming, I'm making a big assumption, not that big of an assumption, but people from Hell's Kitchen, you know, are street hustlers at this point. You know, this guy comes out of Hell's Kitchen as a street hustler, and he does a lot of different stuff, but he really starts to find a niche in scalping tickets, like, for events, like getting the tickets. You know, people are getting him the tickets, and his job is to sell them for more than they paid. And so, for different events, like the Metropolitan Opera House and different events like this, and he gets really good at it. And, like, and so he gets to the point where he starts up his own business in scalping tickets, and then he's doing these, like, odd things where he's, and this is straight out of Richard Back's book, of course, where he's talking about, he does a great write-up, and I'd read the quote, but it's, I don't want to take too much more time with it.
Yeah.
But anyways, he's doing stuff where he's setting up, like, a lemonade stand. And he's giving away free peanuts to, like, at these different, like, while people are waiting in line or doing whatever, and, like, you know, getting their mouths all salty so that they need the lemonade. And then, like, you know, charging, you know, making money off the lemonade sales. Like, that's the kind of guy this the guy is. He's, like, setting the stage here to make more money over here. And so eventually, like, there was a he started working with Tex Rickard, which one of the first episodes we did for this Joe Louis segment, he was Tex Rickard. We talked about how he was like the biggest promoter in all of boxing.
Uh-huh.
And he worked like, I mean, he worked with Tex Rickard. He was doing business with Tex Rickard. And like, I mean, he wasn't just like a protege. He was doing business with Tex.
Okay.
And so some of the biggest early fights of the early 20th century, like the Jack Johnson fights and this, Mike Jacobs was a young man and doing things where he's like helping Tex Rickard out with this one component of this. And then Tex Rickard's giving him like a block of seats for free.
Oh.
And then he was like selling those tickets for like, you know, pure profit and making a ton of money off of it. So he got rich as a result. And so when Tex Rickard died, I think it was 1929 that Tex Rickard died. Tex Rickard was one of the main people responsible, if not the guy, for Madison Square Garden, at least in the way that in its inception at that moment. I think it was the third incarnation of Madison Square Garden. And Tex Rickard was like, for the third incarnation of Madison Square Garden, he was like solely responsible.
Okay.
So he was the guy that like built Madison Square Garden, at least in the third version of it. And he was like the guy for all the big events. And so because he had worked so closely with Tex Rickard, and because he actually had like an office at Madison Square Garden, he was intimately connected. Mike Jacobs and others in his circle thought that when Tex Rickard died, that Mike Jacobs was next in line to basically take over the Madison Square Garden and to run it.
Yeah.
But that was not to be the case.
Nope.
To go to Jesse's question from earlier, was that they turned it over to basically like a bureaucrat, like, you know, the people that own the building just kind of had a friend or somebody, that guy named Jimmy Johnston.
Politics, yeah.
Sort of politics. And Mike Jacobs was like, you know, what are you talking about? Like, I came out of Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah, yeah.
And made myself a multimillionaire.
This is my turn.
Purely on my ability to sell tickets and promote events. And you're going to turn it to this guy over here? So that's what was the situation. So Mike Jacobs was like shut out of the Madison Square Garden. And so that this Jimmy Johnston, who, you know, this is the guy that would eventually shut the door in Joe's face. But basically the year he took over is when the Depression hit. And so Jimmy Johnston, Richard Beck does a phenomenal job talking about this. This is a great section in his book. I really encourage anybody to read this book that is interested in Joe Louis. It's a phenomenal book. Anyways, when Jimmy Johnston takes over, the Depression hits, and then in the Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney had retired. So those were the two big draws of the 1920s. And so now boxing is just like sort of like, there's no star. There's not really a star. So like when Gene Tunney retired, he retired with his belt. So now it was like, well, who's going to be the heavyweight champion?
Yeah.
They didn't even know. So they had a fight between the two sort of up and comer, biggest, you know, closest top was Max Schmeling and a guy named Jack Sharkey.
Okay.
And so there was a fight to determine the vacated title. And so Max Schmeling wins that title. This is on June 12th, 1930.
All right.
Max Schmeling wins the title because Jack Sharkey hit him below the belt, punched him below, but accidentally, you know, I don't know if accident, but he punched him below the belt, caught him in the, you know, the spot you ain't, guys don't want to get hit by. And because of that low blow, Max Schmeling wins the title by disqualification. Okay. So back to Jesse's question. Yeah, he Rochambeau. Great. Thank you, Jesse. Thank you, Jamie. So Max Schmeling gets Rochambeau'd for the title.
Into the title.
He gets the if you're a boxing fan, this is sort of to Jesse's question here about the, you know, does it surpass? And the answer I gave, at least, where he's saying, okay, great, the heavyweight championship was decided by a Rochambeau to the other guy. That's how it's won. So is that really really, if you're a boxing fan, is that what you want to see? For your, you know, like, oh, our heavyweight champion, is Schmeling really the title holder? It's not to take anything from Schmeling, but it's like, if you're a boxing fan, you want to see somebody get knocked out for the title.
Yeah.
You know? So that's not what happens. So Schmeling wins the title. And then in a rematch in 1932, Sharkey wins, beats Schmeling, and takes the title. So it's like a couple years later. And then, so by all accounts, the decision, it was by decision. It wasn't even a knockout. Sharkey wins the championship in 1932 in what is known as, in boxing, in the world of boxing, as the worst decision in ring history.
Oh.
So by all accounts, if anybody that was there, Schmeling should have retained his belt, but Sharkey won it. It was a terrible decision by the judges. And so now the belt changes hands. And, you know, so the first title in Jimmy Johnson's you know, illustrious career is won by Rochambeau, okay? The second title in 32 is won, but the worst decision in ring history. So if you're a boxing, so and then you know, if you're a boxing fan, this is not what you're looking, you know, this is not great, okay? So in 1933, Primo Carnera, who we're going to do a ton of information about him coming up in probably the next episode.
Okay.
Who the Man Mountain from Italia, he beats Sharkey. He's a little bit more of a draw because he's this massive man. He's this huge, huge guy. And Primo Carnera, and I've always said Primo Carnera doesn't get the appreciation he gets. This is a beast of a man, and he is, and when you watch, we're going to show some clips with Primo Carnera against Joe Louis, because this guy doesn't stop swinging when he's in a ring. He's not a technical boxer at all. Mm-hmm. He's kind of like a people mocked him because he was of his circus, you know, like a freak show appearance.
Yeah.
Because he was such a huge guy. He's like, I don't even know how big I've got to look at the stats, but he was like 6'8", 270 or something.
Jeez.
I mean, he's this huge guy. And so he beats Sharkey to take the title in 1933. And then the following year, Max Baer beats Carnera and takes the title in 34. But no matter how you want to define it, none of these guys were like superstars.
Right.
None of them. It was like the belt was just getting passed from one fighter to another. And now, as we read from my little story at the beginning here, you know, Max Baer is really more—he's more of an entertainer. He likes the entertainment component of boxing. I mean, he's got a lethal knockout. Max Baer is one of the hardest punches in boxing history, and he's a great boxer. But he's not like the superstar that boxing is for. In fact, he plays more of like the, you know, more of the like the guy, you know, the what do they call it, the foil, that where everybody he's more playing for the crowd. He wants the crowd to like not like him.
So the villain,
he's the heel. He plays the heel, you know. So he is not, you know, he's an entertainer, but he's not the superstar knockout artist that's just destroying people every day.
Much better in Beverly Hills Billies.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, that's his son.
I know.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
No, I would love to. Yeah, it's so. Anyways, Jethro Bodine, Beverly Hillbillies. That's Max Baer's son. I love Max Baer Jr. Yeah.
Love it.
So, anyways, and so, this is the sort of situation of boxing at the time. You've got Mike Jacobs, a phenomenal promoter, looking from the outside in, and then boxing on the inside is basically like deteriorating. It's not. There's nothing going on. It's a humdrum sport. You've got, you know, it's just the titles getting passed to another guy every year, and so. So it's really at this point where
we're still just in February, March of 35.
Yeah, we're still in March, yeah.
All right.
So Joe, just to get this out of the way, because it's real quick. March 8th, 1935, Joe Louis fights Don Red Barry and gets a third round knockout, $3,200. This is in San Francisco. Just wanted to get that. Nothing super detailed about that. Just want to throw that out there.
Mm-hmm.
Because now we're going to talk about, this is one of the most important components of the entire Joe Louis story, and this is how we're going to really wrap this episode up, is talking about this. This is a major thing, okay, what's about to happen. So Mike Jacobs, as we've just identified, is somebody who, again, is on the outside looking in, okay? And now, as the title of the episode begins, the title of the episode, if you haven't seen it yet, besides it's solid episode, you know, episode 44, the City of Champions, is we have it on there, the Milk Fund for Babies.
Okay.
Like I love to start, like, what in the heck are you talking about? Like,
yeah,
the Milk Fund for Babies.
I've been waiting all show for you to explain this to me.
So without any further ado, okay. So the milk, so the Madison Square Garden had a, so there, so the most powerful newspaper mogul of his time was William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
Okay. William Randolph Hearst. So his wife, Millicent, had a charity called the Milk Fund for Babies.
Okay.
Okay. And the way that the little system they had worked was that the Hearst newspapers, especially in New York, would give the Madison Square Garden, and I'm sure other different elements of, you know, of New York, not just this, but in particular, this relates to this story. Madison Square Garden got free promotion from the Hearst newspapers in New York for all of their events.
Mm-hmm,
so whenever there was an event at the Garden, they got all this hype from the newspaper writers. And in exchange, a cut of the gate would go to Millicent Hearst's charity, the Milk Fund for Babies. Okay.
Okay.
Yes. And so that was like their little arrangement that they had. Okay. But as the arrangement went on. And so, you know, Millicent didn't want to have to beg her husband for money all the time.
Sure.
He was super wealthy, ridiculously wealthy, but she didn't want to have to go to her husband and ask for money all the time. She wanted to run her charity. And so anyways, so as the Depression set in, that money coming, and as the fights got lamer and lamer, and the there wasn't as much of a draw for these big fights,
right.
The money started to dry up at Madison Square Garden. And so one of the things that they cut out was the money for the Milk Fund for Babies.
I don't think so.
They cut the money for the charity for the Milk Fund for Babies. So the writers for these newspapers, for these the sports editors, realized that this money was not coming off from the Madison Square Garden anymore. The spigot was turned off.
Yeah.
And so they approached Mike Jacobs about how do we turn this – not only just how to turn the spigot back on to get this milk money flowing again – but how? But not only that, since it's like kind of a free agent deal here, since we're like now we're reaching out to a different group besides the Madison Square Garden to throw this attention to, maybe we can get a little cut of that cream. You see what I'm saying? Like we're going to give tons of the milk fund.
Yeah.
What if we form a group of people? What if we form a group of people who whose goal is to promote these fights and make all this money and even give more money than previously donated to the milk fund? But in the process, we compensate ourselves for our efforts.
Sure.
See, we compensate ourselves.
It's only fair.
We'll work harder with the compensation, you see? And so that's when they approach Mike Jacobs, who's this guy, he's outside looking in.
Yeah.
They're looking for a way to, to bring revenue to a new group that's going to, restart this money machine. And so out of this this concept was formed. So this is, I'll tell you the names. Mike Jacobs, of course, as we mentioned. A guy named Edward Frain, who was a sports editor of the New York American.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Farnsworth, who was a sports editor of the New York Journal. And Damon Runyon, who was one of the most celebrated writers of his era.
Okay.
Out of this four-man syndicate was created a company called the 20th Century Sporting Club.
Oh.
And that when it was this, and then the writers, of course, were the silent, as Richard Beck says in his book, the very silent partners.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they don't want anybody talking about like all this hype. They're just basically given, Mike Jacobs basically is now going to direct that and through that, wall-to-wall sports coverage in whatever direction he wants it to go in. But now he just needs... he just needs something to something real big to promote.
Yeah.
He needs himself a champion. He needs him to find the next big thing. And here he is at the Lee Ramage fight. Here he is in California watching Joe Louis
take on Lee Ramage. Thing.
Dismantle Lee Ramage in the Lee Ramage is the top 10 boxer, and Joe Louis KOs him in the second round.
Ah.
So Mike Jacobs is like, I think I got my guy.
Yeah.
He's a black man in a world where black fighters aren't supposed to get a title shot.
Sure.
But you know what? He's a knockout artist.
Right.
And the only color I see is green. It's green.
Good Lord.
Yeah, so here we go. So now we get into the actual March 29th, 1935. Mike Jacobs and this group of journalists, or this group of these sports editors, they send 30 New York sports writers to Detroit for Joe's next fight on March 29th, 1935. This is Joe's 16th fight against a guy named Natty Brown.
All right.
Now, Joe doesn't necessarily destroy Natty Brown. He doesn't actually have the greatest fight he had. He beats him. It's a 10th-round decision. It's a 10-round decision at Olympia Stadium. Joe gets $6,500 for this fight. But it's not, it's not his best fight. And it's at this point that Mike Jacobs has a meet. After the fight's over, Mike Jacobs brings all 30 of these reporters. He brings Joe Louis and his entire entourage, and they all go to a bar in Paradise Valley. According to Richard Beck in his book, it's called a Black and Tan.
Okay,
which caters to black and white patrons.
Oh, okay. Right.
And so in the bar is called the Frog Club.
All right.
Okay. And so at this Frog Club, it's this huge party, and I totally wrote about it in my book, in my screenplay. This is like a key component, and it's at this party, Joe and Mike Jacobs and all of us, the 30 journalists aren't there sitting at the table.
Yeah.
They're all out partying and doing whatever. And so Joe's like, well, I didn't have the greatest fight, and Mike Jacobs is like, trust me, kid, it was perfect. It was good enough. And so it's at this meeting where they really hash out the plans, and in the bathroom of the Frog Club that they agree to the terms of this deal, which is that Mike Jacobs is going to be the overall promoter of Joe Louis, and he's going to sign a 3-year deal with Joe, with an option to renew the deal after 3 years is over. And Joe's cut's going to be 37.5% of the gate after this. I'm not sure, and this I get that number from Richard Beck, and I'm not sure if 37.5%, I think that that's Joe's cut. Okay, I'm not sure. I think that his managers. I want to think that his managers got another 37.5, and that Jacobs got the other 37. Like, wow. Really divided into three pieces.
Okay,
I think that's the way that it went down because I don't know if that 37.5 is split between Joe and all of his managers. I gotta look into that. I think I've got it somewhere, but anyways, it's at this moment that this deal is signed. And the plan is hatched. The plan has come up. And the plan going forward, so Mike Jacobs just looks at Joe and says, I can make you the heavyweight champion of the world. Or at the very least, I can get you a shot at that. Mm. And for Joe and for all of his managers who are like, they couldn't even get a fight at Madison Square Garden like a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And now here's this guy telling them, not only can I get you a fight at Madison Square Garden or at one of these other big venues, I can get you a shot at the heavyweight belt. Okay, this is like,
sign me up.
This but this is beyond any of their wildest expectations. You know, I mean, imagine, you know, this is only a year and a 3 months. It's really only been about 8 total months since Joe was even an amateur.
Sure, yeah.
And now they got a guy that's like, you're a star, and I'm about to get you a shot at the heavyweight belt. Jeez. And so, like, Joe's like, where do I? You know, they signed it in the bathroom of the Frog Club. They signed this deal. You know, and so. The plan is that Joe is going to go out west and he's going to fight like 4 or 5 fights. And during these 4 or 5 fights, like, you know, sort of circle in the Midwest, that during these 5 fights, it's going to give these writers time to start putting out ink on Joe.
And just pound
New York, saying, the mentality is there's this invincible fighter coming from the West. That he's coming from the West and he's making his way east. Yeah. And when he gets here, he's going to change the world. Like, I mean, he's going to be the greatest thing that has ever been seen. So you know, it's going to give time for this hype machine to build.
Right, yeah.
And so we're going to see when Joe arrives in Detroit, or I'm sorry, in New York, it's going to be we're going to get it to the next episode. It's just going to be the biggest thing. Like these writers like did too good of a job because Joe can't even get off the train. He's like, you're going to see, he's getting carried off the train through crowds of people.
Good Lord.
And he's not really even won. Like he's beat these, like, you know, Lee Ramage is a top 10 guy for sure, but he hasn't beaten any of the top 1 or 2 or 3 guys. He hasn't, you know, Max Bayer's, you know, that sees the top of the heap.
Sure.
And so Joe is, you know, he's going to arrive in New York, and now this point where the pressure is going to really start. You know, before, Joe's trying to win fights, make money, great. Yeah. But we're going to see Joe evolve from merely this, you know, this boxer who's trying to make some money for his family.
Well, he was doing okay here.
He's doing great, yeah,
on these,
sure.
Because you have a breakdown of his winnings.
He's making money, sure.
And he made $20,000 in the first 3 months. He only made $4,000 or like almost $5,000 in all of 34. He made $20,000 in the first 4 months.
Of 1935.
Of 1935. Yeah. Today's money, that's about $400,000.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wait, yeah. So, and this is just beginning. There's blank boxes that we're going to fill in.
There's blank boxes that we're going to fill in. Oh, my gosh.
So, that's what I'm saying, though, is that, but Joe is going to evolve. Like, again, like, it's important to see, like, this evolution of Joe from this guy from Buckaloo, Alabama, who's like eighth of ninth kids. Come north, and he, you know, like, and now, like, I mean, just really just a couple of years later, like, the most unlikely of heroes.
Sure.
And he's not just going to be a guy who's trying to, like, make a couple of, you know, make some extra money boxing. Now, all of a sudden, he's going to emerge as, like, really thrust into the role of being, like a hero for African American, you know, for black people.
Right.
He's going to all of a sudden have this role where they're going to, like, I mean, I want to say deify him, but, I mean... But, you know, one step below,
right.
because he is like, he's going to become like the first true universal African-American superstar where everybody, like white and black, loved him.
No pressure
and
there.
So, that's what I'm saying. But not only that is the pressure of being, because if he fails, if, you know, if having been heralded as the next big thing, he fails. That's a lot to, you know, like. It's a lot to lose.
I mean,
it's a humiliation. Yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, it's a like, and we're going to see next episode. That like the you know groups like the NAACP and that like in the early phases of all Joe Louis is getting all this praise is like, oh my God, you know, there's this black man is about to be a sports superstar for the first one that there ever was. And like even like these groups like the NAACP that are like, well, we can't go full committal yet because he hasn't won these big fights yet. They're not sure if he's really going to be the guy, you know, like they can't go all in yet. You know, like it's just this huge, it's this dynamic that's going to take place in this emerging role of Joe Louis. Like I say, on the shoulders of this incredibly unlikely individual is going to be thrust this huge mantle of responsibility of being the symbol of possibility.
Well, he's got this, he's got that good foundation.
Absolutely. That is mama. That's what's going to really help carry him. And that's really what's going to help to carry him. Yeah. Absolutely.
I can't wait to get into the next episode to find out where we go next.
Me either. I'm already throwing out teasers.
And all stuff. Right. All right. So we'll be back again. Thanks for joining us. We appreciate you spending your time and diving through these stories with us. It's Detroit City of Champions. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.